I know it's hard to believe, but the Celtic Underground podcast is back after some intermittent service this season. Here we are. So I hope you had a good festive period, an enjoyable new year and Christmas. Mine was pretty hectic. Unfortunately, my 99-year-old gran passed away, and I didn't actually get to see the Celtic Rangers game as a consequence. Went to see her one final time. It doesn't appear as though I missed that much. I heard the first half hour in the car, and that was enough for me. Anyway, decided to get Mark Cooper on the podcast to discuss what we always discuss in January with Mark Cooper about the transfer window. So this is me, Harry Brady, with him, Mark Cooper. So the podcast is back. I'm joined by Mark Cooper. How you doing, Mark?
Very good, Harry. Happy New Year to everyone.
Yeah, Happy New Year. Merry Christmas. Happy Easter. Merry Summer.
Halloween.
Halloween. Bonfire Night. And everything else in between. So what should we talk about?
I think from about AK Athens onwards.
Right, okay. Right, okay. We'll just do AK Athens onwards. So very, very briefly, managing the board aren't getting along. Dedric Boyata doesn't play. We get knocked out of the Champions League. How did you feel about that?
In fact, I was back for about 3 weeks over the summer, and my brother and I went to the Athens game. Mm-hmm. We flew over to the Athens game, and it was that kind of. We're actually, although it was a joke, we're actually going to analyse the AK Athens game. And it was funny, before the game we were chatting about it, and we're kind of talking about like the probability that we're going through or not. And we're kind of thinking, how often is it that a kind of quite open team that's poor defensively beats the solid defensive team away from home when they need a win and a solid defensive team just need to kind of close out the game and they're through? And although we had the better players and whatever, there's a probability of that happening. Like, you've seen that so often.
Yeah.
It just, the kind of slightly fragile attacking team is going to get caught out at some point by the kind of solid.
Seen it so often, Mark. I've been supporting Celtic since 1974. An attacking team who's fragile at the back, who you think they're going to get through, and then they just lose a goal in the break and it all falls to pieces. I've seen it many times.
Yeah.
So,
one other thing about that game, mm-hmm. when we're up in the stand, so as soon as the final whistle went, Dembele went over to the fans and was saying, it was pretty obvious to everyone, he was saying a goodbye.
Yep.
Like, it was more than just a kind of standard quick clap to the fans.
There was two people I know of for whom that wasn't obvious. And well, they seemed to be taken by surprise.
Were they in the stadium?
One of them was in the director's box and one of them was in the dugout.
Okay. Well, for everyone who is up there, the way he came over and then he went straight to the tunnel instead of like shaking hands with people, and then was kind of directed to go back on the pitch and kind of shake hands to people, and then he seemed to go off. That's what I remember from it. But he had spent about, I don't know, 40 seconds, a minute just clapping at fans and kind of like putting like one hand up or whatever he did. It seemed like a pretty obvious gesture that he was off. And then in the next, like, say, 4 or 5 days, when the news came through that he was going to be leaving, like, it was pretty obvious. It was pretty obvious. Anyway, we're talking about something about six months ago.
Yeah, synopsis of the season, because that didn't feed into what we can chat about with the transfer window and stuff. Synopsis of the season, we're playing dull, boring football in the first 5 or 6 games. We're averaging less than a goal a game, or there or thereabouts. Then suddenly, we get some injuries. Christie comes into the team. We play a slightly different way, and we start winning games and start scoring goals. And then the manager brings back players for big games and we don't win them, like Hibs and Rangers. And then, so we've ended up winning just 4 of 11 away league games. And it was during one of the home games that I was watching, and I was thinking about our passive style of passing last season, where a lot of it was sideways passing. And there was a game at home this season where I thought it really summed up one of the changes, and it was the ball was played out wide to Lustig, and most of last season and the first quarter of this season, he'd have turned and played the ball back to the centre half, but he didn't. He turned the other way, played the ball down the line to, I think it was, or played the ball inside to McGregor, who then played it to Forrest, who went in and scored a goal. Can't remember which league game it was. It was just at the start of us playing decent football. And one of the things that dawned on me in one of our home games in December, and I liken Cham, but our most lateral passing system has coincided with the arrival of Inchan in the team in Brendan's second season. And our abandonment and our more forward passing this season has been when Brown and Cham were both injured and neither of them were playing the team at the same time. And then some of our poorer performances came when both of them were back in the team at the same time. Am I reading too much into it, or do you think part of the problem is that we can't necessarily have Brown and Cham in the team at the same time?
No, I think we've had good games when both have played, and I think, like, I seem to remember the Aberdeen game last season. When would that have been? Would that have been shortly after we were beaten by Bayern in Munich? And
is that one of the
dodgy
where we went and just played them off the
and
park?
We hammered them.
Yeah,
and I'm pretty sure it was Brown and Cham in a kind of side by side, but quite defensive, with Rogic and McGregor as kind of floating behind Aberdeen's midfield, and there was no Sinclair, right. And we seemed to just, the Aberdeen players didn't really know how to pick up both of them, and it just seemed as though we passed the ball around them all day, and we're just creating chances all the time. I think there's a correlation in what you're saying, but also it kind of depends on, like, the level of opposition as well. When you can have that midfield of Rogic, McGregor and Christie as a midfield three, however, if we're playing Bayern Munich or Juventus away tomorrow, there's no way I'm going with that. There's no way. And people can, like, people have been getting on Brown's back, and he had a poor game at Ibrox a few weeks ago. But for me, he starts as that kind of defensive midfield anchor. In, like, if you raise the level of opposition, for me, he starts every time. And possibly he is on a
in that position.
Yes. And I know probably about 85-90% of people disagree with me right now saying that, but I don't think Brown, since he's come back, has been, like, completely fit and has been in his proper rhythm. And say 2 years ago, for me, he was easily player of the year, even though Sinclair won it. He was easily our best player in the Champions League 2 years ago. Last year, he was comfortably player of the year, and then everyone basically voted him as being player of the year. So this season, he's kind of, for me, he hasn't been kind of consistently playing, and he's picked up an injury, and, you know, and he's tried to come back in a team that had a different kind of passing pattern. But if you think about it, if we jump forward, if we're talking about Brown proper, and we jump forward to the Rangers game, for me, okay, so controlling a game is all about relationships, knowing where you're passing, but especially when you're playing against a better team and there's more pressing and less time on the ball, you need to know where your partner's going to be in midfield, and you need to be able to like find him quickly, almost without looking. He's always going to be there. Mm-hmm. In Cham and Christie, how many times have they played together? Mm-hmm. Once, twice, yeah, in midfield? And not even in those positions either. Not as the two midfielders who are kind of shuttling back and forth with Brown as a kind of anchor. I don't think they've ever played together for a full game. And if you think about that game, and everyone back home thinks about that game, and think about how much of the play was between Incham and Christie, it barely existed. Mm-hmm. There wasn't any sort of relationship. Now, if you put McGregor instead of one of those two, or possibly, as I would have done, both, you have both them there, and you take out Sinclair, and you say, we're just going to pass the ball and try and control this game, and you know what? A 0-0, a 1-1 is fine, but we're going to have the ball. We're going to have 65% of the ball, as we did again, as we've been doing to Rangers, what, in the last 5 years consistently. And second half, we can throw on, you know, Sinclair. For me, Edwards should have started, even though I think Johnson had a pretty good game. I thought he actually linked up well, even though Walker was slating him all the time. He actually linked up well. Mm-hmm. But and even like even if you then talk about Izaguirre, when Izaguirre was taken off against Aberdeen, my immediate thought was, ah, that means Tierney's fit. Because you wouldn't take off our only left back 3 days before the most important league game of the season unless the proper left back is fit.
Or unless you think your only other left back is just not even capable of playing at that level.
He had a very good game at home a few weeks ago when, by all accounts, he was man of the match. He had a very good game away at Partick Thistle at the start of the season. He's only played about 3-4 games. And he had the game at Aberdeen where he conceded the penalty and was taken off after 45 minutes. Now, for me, it's more preferable to have a guy who's been capped, 70, 80 times, played in, 15 or so Rangers games, mm-hmm, to have him there, then take your best passing midfielder and put him at left back.
I think we got the
team pretty badly wrong.
I was going to say, from what you're saying, is the manager completely and utterly mucked up in the team?
That isn't close to the lineup I've chosen.
How do you think he got it so wrong?
Perhaps he thought that we were going to be able to rotate the ball, and McGregor, although nominally he's a left back, as with Tierney, like these fullbacks nowadays basically almost play like a kind of wide midfielder nowadays. Mm-hmm. But if you think about, I remember a few weeks ago looking at a kind of heat map of the Man City fullbacks and also Andy Robertson, and it's probably pretty similar to a heat map that David Beckham would have had, where he just has the ball mostly about 10 metres inside the opposition's half, and he's reaching the byline and he's going back to the edge of his box. Now, if we're going to be dominating against Rangers and McGregor's there and we've got all the ball, you think, that's actually a decent place for a good passing midfielder to have the ball. Mm-hmm. But we didn't have 65-70% possession. And for me, that's partly because of the kind of a lack of relationships between Incham, Christie and Brown in that midfield, that they were getting flustered when they were getting the ball. Also, the passing from the back was very poor as well into midfield. like, we very rarely got it up to Sinclair, Johnson and Forrest. And in fact, Sinclair and Forrest were coming back pretty beat that Johnson, there probably wasn't another player for about 25 metres.
Yeah, I think, was it something like in the first half, Boyata passed the ball straight out of the park on five occasions or something like that? Yeah. And I think Benkovic, you know, had
unfortunately, Benkovic, it was almost like catching. It was almost that his passing went as well.
Yeah, you know, if you look at his stats, he played like a 21-year-old playing in his first big derby game.
Yeah.
So, onto the meat and bones of what happens in January, the transfer window. So, the January transfer window. So far, we have signed Timothy Weir, Oliver Burke, both on loan. The striker who is it? How do you pronounce it?
Bio.
That's
the Bio.
Yep. Reports in America say that we've signed the fullback Gutman.
Yeah. And also, have we also signed another guy called Manny Perez? Or is that?
No, I think we're just
about 2 weeks. Okay.
I think we're just interested in him, and we are interested in a couple of views. So, tell me what you think so far of the transfer window.
You can look at transfers on like various different levels. On the short term, having Burke, Weah, Bio is definitely an enhancement to the squad. The squad is definitely, obviously, stronger with them than without them. I'm not especially keen on loan signings.
You don't say?
No. It's an interesting... Maybe my dad said this, was talking to me about this. It's interesting the amount of signings we've had in fairly similar positions, like that kind, like a creative midfielder type position. Mm-hmm. Like it's Roberts, Musonda, now Burke, Weah. And then you think back to like, well, how many players have we actually signed in that position in the last, say, you know, like proper first team players in the last, say, 4 years or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not... So, if we're just talking about this league season, and we're talking about early on in the January, for this league season, that's definitely strengthened the squad.
Could the issue be, your point about, could the issue be that the type of, the quality of player that we're trying to get for that position is out with our budget? And that's principally why we're having to get them on loan, because we can't afford what we want.
I think they've arrived at that conclusion. I suspect that's a reason. I also think that's incorrect. I think you can.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it interesting that we, almost like the markets that we're buying in, it's kind of reduced a bit. And okay, we've got Bio from Slovakia, so that undermines my point completely. But if you think about it, like, so our transfer, our wage budget, sorry, has gone from something like, what was it, about 36?
Yep.
To
50.
What was it, like 59.3? Is that right?
Just under the 60.
59.3, yeah. Yep. And in that time, we bought players pretty much from either the super rich clubs or the English league. So you think about Sinclair, Dembele, who had kind of fairly, they would have had fairly high wages.
Yep.
Then you think of Edouard, PSG. You think about the various players from Man City. Then you think about Comper, who's at Red Bull Leipzig. who are spending a lot of money on wages.
Mm-hmm.
So to attract a player to your club, you're not offering them less money than they're originally getting.
Yep.
And then you jump from 36 million a year to 59 million a year.
Yep.
And so you can talk about the kind of, okay, there's a hyperinflation of wages in football. But not all economies have the same inflation.
Mm-hmm.
You have inflation in areas where there's a huge excess of new money going in. So English football in the last 4 years or whatever with the new deals, all the wages go up. And then the super rich clubs, PSG, Leipzig, Man City. So if we're talking about hyperinflation, well, Feyenoord, PSV and Ajax's wages have all decreased in the last year. Benfica's has decreased in the last year, according to all of their annual reports.
Mm-hmm.
So there isn't, the hyperinflation is the markets that we're choosing to recruit from.
Mm-hmm.
And then you think, okay, well, are we getting value for money for that? That's kind of my issue with loans, and I completely accept, again, where there are going to be enhancements to the squad for the next 5 months. But at the same time, if Celtic are going to properly progress as a club, we have to have a higher rate of resale than we currently have. And I'm talking about resale over, say, a 10-year period. So our resale over a 10-year period is 28%,
mm-hmm.
according to Transfermarkt. So Salzburg is over 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Benfica and Porto. Benfica get 110%. Porto got 97%. Basel get 109%. And then Ajax get 70%, Anderlecht get 70%, blah, blah, blah. Celtic get 28%.
Because that's one of the things, is we are held up as an exemplar in Scottish football of we buy in talent, we add value, and we sell them. And depending on the mood of the press at the time, and depending on the mood in where we are in Scottish football, we will either be criticised for selling our better players, i.e. Dembele, at the time that we sell them,
yep.
or we will be held up as that's the fantastic role model. Because relative to Scottish football,
well, that's kind of dependent on whether or not we get in the Champions League, right?
Yeah.
If we get into the Champions League and we sold, it's like, oh my God, this is incredible. They've done it again. If we sell and don't get in the Champions League, it's, oh my God, this is incredible. What are they doing?
Yeah, they're selling because it's a fire sale because they're desperate. And yet, as you quite rightly say, we really want to be pitching ourselves against the peers in European football of Ajax, Benfica, Porto, Anderlecht, you know, Salzburg. Those are the clubs that we want to be similar level at in European football.
There are peer clubs.
There are peer clubs. And we are nowhere near their level of buying and selling and quality. And that gets back to the conversation we had at the beginning about the Dembele thing. We all knew when we signed Dembele that was a better quality of player than we would normally expect.
Yeah.
And that we were hopefully going to break all records with the sale of him. And at some point, somebody was going to come in with an offer that would be too good for us to refuse. Everybody knew that was the case. So when Leon first speak to us on the Saturday before the transfer window closes, I just can't comprehend how we were not ready for that. I mean, you've told me in text messages, so tell the people in the podcast, how prepared would Salzburg be for that situation, for example?
Well, they already have the player in.
Yeah, so people might say we had Edward in. But no, from what you told me, we would have signed Dembele's replacement the transfer window before we brought in Dembele. And then Dembele would be the guy who would then replace him.
I'm trying to remember the text message from
You pointed out to me, in fact, I'll see if I can see it, because you pointed out to me that Salzburg sold a centre-half for 20 million quid and in the same transfer window signed, or 20 million euros, and in the same transfer window signed a centre-half for 2 million euros.
Yeah.
But the replacement for the 20 million euro guy was the guy who was signed in the transfer in the summer before.
Yeah. It's a logical squad planning. And Benfica did the same thing. Benfica have brought in a player who had an Argentinian centre-back who had a $3 million release clause. And he won't be able to oust their main star centre-back who they're going to be selling next summer. But he's there and he'll be playing, what, 15, 20 games this season? And he'll just be getting used to European football.
Uh-huh.
And then they'll sell their highly rated, highly valued kid.
So in the Celtic model, for example, if you were to use our strikers at the moment, then effectively what you're saying is we would sign somebody next January for 2-3 million quid, sell Edward, for example, for 25 million quid the following year, and at the same time, at the same time sign somebody else for 2-3 million quid, so that actually in 2 years' time Bayou would be replacing Edward, and the guy who we buy in the summer would be would be the number two to Bayou, and then we would sign a third guy, so that permanently you've got a year or 2 years of the guy before he becomes the number one guy, as opposed to us who we sell Dembele and Edward becomes the number one guy straight away.
I think that's kind of most important in centre defence. So, like, squad planning itself, like, we've had, I'm kind of bouncing around here, I'll get back to centre defence. If we just go back to striker, we've had 38 games from the start of the season to the winter break.
Mm-hmm.
And we planned, we went into that 38 games with two centre forwards. Griffiths and a young boy who front to goal is excellent and back to goal needs a lot of work.
Who was the third choice striker last season.
Yeah. So, I don't think it's that controversial to say that's pretty poor squad planning for a squad and a club that is expecting stroke hoping to be in the Champions League.
Yeah.
The season before, we went the whole season, that's almost 70 games, with one left back, one senior left back.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's very good squad planning. We had Calvin Miller, who's what, a youth who came up, played a few games and whatever, but I think for a Champions League club, squad planning...
Which may be now starting to come home to roost, because Kieran Tierney's been out, and Brendan Rodgers today is, or coming last night I think it was saying that Tierney might need an operation on his hip.
Yeah. So, going back to centre-back, I think it's either four or the last 5 years, we've had a centre-back who's playing the most important games of the season, the final qualifiers to get us into Champions League, have been players with no European experience at all. So to get through these games away from home in what, Azerbaijan or Israel or wherever, Sweden,
mm-hmm.
and you have players who've never played at that level before. And that has been the case in either the last four seasons or the last five seasons. So I think there are a lot of improvements that we can make in squad planning, squad composition. Rodgers came in. When Rodgers came in, he said the squad was too big.
Mm-hmm.
The squad is now bigger.
Bigger.
Way bigger.
34 first-team players. Four goalkeepers.
It's a really poor management of a limited budget. It's also poor in cultivating assets and getting a higher resale. For instance, I was talking to someone on Twitter today about like strikers and, you know, in the last 10 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. From 2012 to 2016, we had 20 centre forwards. I can go through them if you want, it'll be pretty boring. But we had 20 centre forwards on a limited budget, and we're playing against other teams who we have more or less the same wages. Maybe we have less wages, maybe we have bigger wages, and we're spreading it across a stupidly large squad, and they're not. This, if you talk about our peer clubs, so the three from Portugal, the three from Holland, mm-hmm. then you add what? Anderlecht, Basel, Salzburg, what? Our wages of 59.3 million are almost exactly the same as PSV and Feyenoord's together. Feyenoord's is 30, PSV's is 33. Mm-hmm. It's a poor management of resources. It's poor squad fun. And then, if you go back to the 20 strikers from 2012 to 2016, Skepovic and Baldi and, you know, Gadetti and whoever. So if you bring in, this is another issue with loans, if you bring in a guy like Gadetti for a year, and you've also just signed Pukki or Skepovic or whoever, mm-hmm. and Gadetti becomes the main striker, how do you think the valuation that you've just spent 2.5 million, 3 million on Skepovic?
Yep.
How do you think that valuation on Skepovic is going to go when he gets 5-6 games a season? Or Baldi the year before, who's been, okay, he just sent away. So, just this poor squad composition and poor squad management on a wage budget that's pretty comparable to our peer clubs. It's only Porto and Benfica have higher ones of that list. So I do think we can do better. And this is so negative. I know people are kind of just...
No, but it's a relative thing because we spend that money and we have the best squad in Scotland and we've won the treble the past two seasons and there's a very good chance we'll win the treble again this season. But we all want to do better and compete better in Europe. And what you're pointing out is that if you compare us with our peers at European football, we've got turnover or income that's in the top of those group of clubs that we've talked about, the elite clubs in Holland and Portugal and Switzerland and Austria. We've got
only, just to briefly interrupt you, only Celtic and Benfica have broken 100 million revenue.
Yeah, so in terms of revenue, we are the elite of our peers in European football. In terms of wage bills, we're the elite of our peers. In terms of coefficients, we're the bottom of that list. So if we've got more, so that's why, you can have these two conversations. You can say we are the best team in Scotland, but we should be doing better in Europe. And the reason we should be doing better in Europe is because in terms of wages and income, we outperform the vast majority of the teams that we would like to compete with. Uh-huh. But in terms of on the pitch, which is where it all matters, we're the poorest performer of the teams we want to compete with.
Well, yeah, and it's quite... So we have a strong economic base, but the coefficient... And this isn't just like opinion. This is just facts on all of these clubs' audited accounts, mm-hmm. and the annual reports taken from last year, and this is a coefficient. In the coefficient, we're second bottom. Feyenoord almost went bust like 5 years ago and have barely played in Europe. They're bottom of that. But we have, what, 31,000 points. Porto have 90, Ajax have 61, Benfica have 60, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Like,
they're considerably ahead of us. And the key, and our wages in that list of 10 is third behind Benfica and Porto, higher than everyone else. So the key to it is, the key for Celtic progressing is to get our resale, which is the lowest in the list, up. Because you can have as much or more money than the other clubs, but if you don't have the capital to buy players, then it's, if we're still buying at 2 million mm-hmm. and Salzburg, who have a lower revenue than us, but have higher resale, because in their accounts, in the annual accounts, they don't count player sales.
Right.
So, for instance, the 10-year spend of Celtic will be 96 million.
Mm-hmm.
The 10-year spend of Porto, who have a lower revenue than us, is 340.
So it is wholly down to scouting correctly, to getting the right quality of player. And as we've seen, we got 20 million quid for Dembele because he played Champions League football. We got £8 million for Armstrong because we played Champions League football. If you are then playing in the Champions League, because people might turn in and say, well, you see, the problem we can't get those sorts of sales for players is because of the league we're playing in. But actually, we've shown if you're playing Champions League football and competing, you can get those types of income for players, and then you can reinvest it. And selling is not a weakness, it's just part of the general business model that allows you. We see it as a weakness because we have one player who is dramatically better than everybody else, and we sell him, and then we buy in a replacement who's not as good, and so we no longer have that star player. Whereas what these teams are doing, as you're just pointing out, to do with the was it Porto there, or was it Benfica? Which one was it?
Porto have
Porto
spend of 340, Benfica 320.
Yeah, so what they're doing is their base level is at a higher level than ours.
Yeah, and they're quite comfortable and confident in spending higher amounts than us.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have a sustainable model, because they're going to the markets that provide better resale. And they're quite comfortable, and it's proven over a 10-year period. They're making, them together, they're making double the money on that 340 million or that 323 million. They're doubling every time. We, on the other hand, are making a profit of 28%.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it works fantastically well. And credit should be given to a club for getting Van Dijk on, what, three? Two and a half, three?
Mm-hmm.
Wanyama? One?
Mm-hmm.
So we changed that.
800 grand, I think, Wanyama was actually even.
And if you think about it, so we went to the Benelux countries. And it's not only, like, although I kind of focus in South America because I work here
mm-hmm.
and I live here for the last, like, 10 years or whatever. But if you look at the Benelux market, so we bought three players from there, Borrecta, Van Dijk, Wanyama. We spent about 6 million or so.
Mm-hmm.
What, 5, 6 million, something
like that? Something like that.
And with the resale of Van Dijk, we made, what, over 30 million?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we had one failure with Borrecta, but we had two excellent successes.
Mm-hmm.
That's like market-leading kind of scouting and recruitment. That's brilliant. And how many times have we gone back there?
But it also demonstrates when we had an £8 million offer in for Simonovic 2 years ago, we should have taken it. We should have sold Boyata for £8 million in the summer. But the reason we didn't is because we hadn't subsequently properly scouted to have the replacements in that allowed us to then bring in that guy for 18 months and sell him.
And the thing is, everyone can make bad decisions. like, it's complete human nature to make bad decisions. Like, you might, well, the Boyet one definitely should have been sold, but you might look at a player and look at a bid and think, no, actually, he's got age on the side or whatever. We need him for this campaign and his value isn't going to go down, and then it does go down.
Yeah, like Simonovic is one where you could do that, yeah.
Yeah. But the problem is that the kind of overall kind of scouting or recruitment kind of structure is wrong, in that if you're consistently going for loan players, and we have been, mm-hmm. how are you ever going to get up? How are we ever going to raise the requisite capital to compete at a good level in Europe? Now, Porto, with a lower revenue than us, are the ninth best team in Europe, mm-hmm. according to the five-year coefficient. They're the ninth best, and they have a lower economic base than we do. Now, this, I remember I wrote an article about this. That was 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. It isn't, like, it's quite obvious.
So, do you think part of the problem, do you think the problem's the structure at Celtic?
I think it's like what you said before, where you said that we're getting these loans, but perhaps we won't be able to attract that level of talent. Mm-hmm. I think they reach to the wrong conclusions. My English is getting worse and worse. Reach to the wrong. God. But I'm not completely sure if they realise the level of player you can get if you identify them early. Like, in the same way Salzburg can get them, mm-hmm. same way Porto can get them, we can get them. But you have to make the decision to actually scout in these peripheral kind of regions, or these peripheral leagues in Europe or in South America and whatever. Now, if we think we're going to raise the requisite capital to properly compete at that level by spending money on loan signings, I'm sorry, but you're going to have to convince me. I think the logic is more in my argument than in signing Mbeumo or
Denier. I can see there is a place for loan signings in a January window. You're in a tight league, tight race, you've done proper scouting, and you've had some, and you've got three strikers, and you've done the proper scouting, and you get an unfortunate run of injuries, so as you get into January, you've actually got no striker. And so you think, right, okay, we, you know, on a short term basis, to make sure we finish the, you know, we've got the league to win, and European football still to be played. I can see that there is occasion when there's a benefit of bringing in a loan.
I agree with you.
But what we seem to be doing, and I can see the benefit of, let's bring Edouard in on loan with an option to buy. So you bring in a young talent on loan with the option to buy, so that you're not, because you're not 100%, because he's not played enough first team football to look at him. So I can see the benefit of that. Yeah. What I don't see the point in, like you, really, is, and I can see the benefit of like a Bellamy or a type, when we brought him in, that he'd fallen out with the manager, the you know, an experienced guy, who's a, you know, experienced player in the position, who's above the level that we could normally afford, and he's fallen out with the manager, and you've got a one-off opportunity. Where I really, really don't see the benefit of loan players is what principally we are focusing on, which is going out and loaning players from the elite clubs to give them the first team experience, so that that club can either then play him in his first team or sell him at a profit. You know, unless they should really be paying us. I mean, I know they wouldn't, but you get the principle. They should be paying us for taking these players on loan, because all we're doing is enhancing their value. That in a greater way than they would do if they stayed at that team because he can't get first team football.
Yeah. And it's missing out on... So it kind of presupposes as well that you can't get anything like that quality at that time. Whereas like, someone like Denier, for instance. Mm-hmm. Now, I know you can get... Denier was a good player for us. Mm-hmm. But I know we could have got better centre-backs who were then worth a huge amount of money that then progressed Celtic as a club. Mm-hmm. And the same goes for, you know, like various players.
So, the other way of looking at it, though, is if we have a scouting team who've been put in place by the manager, and he's the manager's guy, and the manager has insisted that he's in place, and he's had three transfer windows which have all been utterly shit, and the manager's leaving in the summer, and so his transfer guy's going with him, then you may have a lot of loans in that in the January transfer window, because you don't trust his transfer guy, and well, it's all going to change in the summer anyway. Think that's an excuse for it?
I don't have any like information within the club, but it does seem slightly short term. But again, we've been doing that. This has been a part of our transfer policy for what, 5-6 years?
Yeah.
So, whether or not if Rodgers was definitely going to be staying or not, we'd probably be looking at loans regardless.
So, is it? Do we actually, you know, because we talk about scouting in different places, an obvious place is the Balkans. Is one area that clubs like Salzburg seem to be shopping to get value for money. And obviously South America, that we've talked ad nauseum in this podcast about. And we talk about the fact that we don't scout there. Do you actually physically have to have guys there? Or is it this thing? Or is it just that you know, because obviously I'm not involved in the scouting world. Do clubs have guys who are in situ in a place? Or do they use the likes of Y Scout and agents sending stuff in and all that type of stuff to then... just to people who it's your remit to pop across to the Balkans and have a look at a player in real life. How does it work?
Yeah, I think the latter. But I think that Y Scout is now slightly replacing that.
Right.
But I also think that it's a mistake to be overly reliant on Y Scout. Mm-hmm. Because you then don't get... If you have a guy that, and if you talk about the cost benefit analysis of transfers now, like transfers should be the kind of economic driver of a club.
Yep.
Therefore, you want an advantage over your competitor. Mm-hmm. Now, if Udinese stroke Watford are down here.
Yep.
And so, for the last 10 years, I work as a scout, and for the last 10 years, whilst living in South America, I've been going to youth games basically every week and a few days a week. Mm-hmm. And I'll bump into or know the people who are down here. And a lot of clubs, like I remember seeing Attilio Lombardo down here for like Man City years ago. Mm-hmm. Looking at a player who's just signed for Ajax. He was about 17 then, and he's just gone to Ajax a couple of days ago, called Magashan. Anyway, I think it's of a benefit to clubs to have guys down here.
So would you have guys as in a salaried member of staff, or would you have a local guy that you have on a retainer, or is it a mixture? Or
well, Udinese have guys who cover regions and who report back to Pozzo.
Right.
As well as obviously using Y Scout, and Udinese have the base of people at the club, basically, going over Wednesday, but then they also have people in the region.
So we should really have one or two people out in the Balkans, one or two people down in South America. That might cost us, well, I don't know.
Well, that's the cost of a salary in the third world. To have a guy covering Colombia and Ecuador,
uh-huh.
A guy in Brazil, a guy in Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, whatever. The cost of that, employing someone in the third world for a year, is minimal compared to the benefit of it.
Mm-hmm.
An example. So there's a player called Ezequiel Palacios who's about to go to Real Madrid for $20 million. He's in 10 years, and I wrote this in the scouting report. In 10 years, he's the best box-to-box, kind of mixed, shuffling back and forth midfielder I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Almiron, who's up at Atlanta just now, Paraguayan, who's going to be going for about 30 million. He's a bit more attacking. Lo Celso is a bit more of a passer. But in terms of a box-to-box midfielder, Palacios is the best. 2 years ago, he was out of contract. He was running out of his contract. It was almost like a Liam Henderson situation where he had played about three or four games. It was 17, 18. But he wasn't properly getting in the team, and it didn't seem as though he was going to be getting in at River 2 years ago. And he was running out of his contract, and no one picked him up. And he signed a new contract for under 4,000 a week. And that was in about May 2017. And since then, bit by bit, he's getting in a team. And now he's starting for Argentina. He's starting for Argentina in a recent friendly at Colombia, and won a Copa Libertadores with River. And now he's going to Real Madrid for $20 million. So to have people at the games every week watching Hajduk Split, Dynamo Zagreb, drive over, watch Partizan Belgrade, Red Star, whatever, living in the region, watching 15, 16, 17s,
mm-hmm.
You're going to see the Modric coming through, or whoever, you know, Mitrovic coming through. Same up in Colombia. Like, the cost of doing that is so minimal to the level of money that the club can receive. And if Celtic are ever going to progress to a high European standard again, we're going to have to do it. Or you can do it with, possibly you can do it with Wisecout, but you're going to be behind 15 other clubs who are out there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you wait for, you know, a player to play 20 games now in Croatia or Argentina, everyone's going to see.
Yeah.
As soon as he plays, if he's half decent, there's going to be 50 clubs watching him on Wisecout.
Mm-hmm. So what you could do is not pay a £1 million bonus to the chief executive, and that would pay your scouting network. Yeah, that would pay your scouting network, no problem. You may, right, away from the doom and gloom bit then.
I know. I apologise.
No, it's okay. There's something else you touched on there.
That's so negative.
There's something else you touched on there that I thought I'll ask you about, that's completely away from the transfer deal.
Uh-huh.
How was Argentina when the Copa de Libertadores shenanigans was going on?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's as big as you can have, it's as big a football game as you can have.
Mm-hmm.
It's us against Rangers in final of the Champions League, and it happens to be that year it's at Hampden Park. You can imagine the tension in the city and whatever, and then like in a society like Argentina is what, a 40 million population with 13, 14, 15 million in Buenos Aires. So it's like febrile kind of atmosphere.
Yep.
And like the G20 was on what, a week later or whatever, and no one paid any attention to it. It didn't exist. I went to the second leg that never happened.
Uh huh.
At River Stadium. And was at the, I'm not sure how well, some people listening to it will kind of remember whatever, but basically the Boca bus is going down to River Plate Stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes through a kind of main thoroughfare, and then cuts in, about 5 blocks, 6 blocks away from River Stadium and kind of makes a turn and goes down. And I was at that corner at about midday. I think the game was meant to be at 5-6. I had picking up the tickets from my friend.
Uh-huh.
And there was like a few thousand people around there. And first of all, it's kind of madness to go through there. Secondly, so I go into a stadium and it's like terracing where I was in, because mm-hmm. it was basically impossible to get a ticket otherwise. And kind of like standing squashed, like one foot on one step, another foot on the other step below, and kind of squashed between people, just standing there waiting for a game to start for about, yes, what, 5-6 hours or something, with only a kind of information over a tannoy every 2 hours or say something saying that the game was delayed. But so the Boca bus goes through this main thoroughfare. 15 minutes before it's to get to that corner to cut in towards River Stadium,
mm-hmm.
with probably about 2,000-3,000 River fans waiting for it to arrive, 4 police units leave that area. Weirdly, leave that area. And if you watch the footage, there's barely no police there.
Is it a bit of a conspiracy theory in Argentina about that?
Yes, completely. Especially because the Boca president is godfather to the son of the head of security of Buenos Aires City, right, who is in charge of the security arrangements for the bus going down there.
Right.
The context is that 3-4 years previously, there was a pepper gas attack from Boca fans on River players as they came out onto the pitch,
right,
in a semi-final, and that meant the game was called off and the game was awarded to River Plate.
Right.
With the kind of conspiracy theory being that it had been arranged so that Boca would then win the cup,
uh-huh,
which I don't believe, but that's, it was probably believed by 90% of River fans here. but yeah, it was a really weird, it's a really weird kind of day. It was almost like the culmination of, because it's as big as a game can be,
uh-huh,
and it never happened before, that they met in the most important game either of them can play. It was just like the complete like pinnacle of Argentinian football, and kind of like, it's hard to describe how big it was.
Yeah.
But yeah, and to be honest, it's pretty disappointing when it was called off. Just completely selfishly. Like, I remember standing up there, like just looking down on the pitch, and it was absolutely perfect, and it was sunny, and I was thinking, oh, this is going to be such an event to watch. And then it was called off. And then I went back the next day, they said it was going to be on the next day, and then that got cancelled. Then it was meant to be in Miami, Medellin, Asuncion, then it got switched to Madrid.
Yeah.
That, it was a bit of a fiasco. Anyway.
So, How many people went to Madrid?
There's about, so there was 5,000 allocation of each side. That was snapped up. Then there was 20,000 for each side of Argentinians living in Spain or the European Union.
Right.
And they were snapped up. And then there was what, I'm trying to do the maths here, but then there was something like another 15,000-20,000 of neutral tickets.
What's the length of flight to Madrid?
Would be about 11 hours, something like that. Yeah.
I mean, why did they... Was there much debate about why they picked Madrid? Because surely there could have been somewhere else in you know, that wasn't an 11-hour flight, or was it basically, how far away can we get this to make sure there's no trouble?
It was quite interesting when they were picking a city, because a few days before they chose Madrid, Doha, I think, is one of the cities over there, I think it was Doha, had offered something like $7 million for it. Mm-hmm. And then Madrid got it. So I assume Madrid offered CONMEBOL quite a lot of money for it.
Right.
But yeah, it was, I don't know if you watch the game. It was good, but at the same time, like the quality of Argentina, I think for people watching it back home, they might be quite surprised at the kind of how frantic Argentinian football is. It's like the fullbacks are trying to take on like half of the team, basically, and like it's pretty kind of aggressive, a lot of fouls, a lot of stop-start, and quite frantic. And Palacios and Palacios won the Copa Libertadores.
So, who are you wanting to win, by the way?
River, a bit. I prefer... In Argentina, I don't really care that much. In Argentina, I prefer San Lorenzo, just because I used to live in that neighbourhood where they play. But a lot of my friends, like proper friends, are River fans.
Right.
And so, yeah, like about 4 or 5 of them flew over there. And it's good. It's good. But the whole event, Argentina is so kind of melodramatic and so focused on football. But then it almost becomes a wee bit like overwhelming and a little bit kind of over the top. But and there's also a kind of sense that like the season, they're on a kind of summer break just now, even though it's the same league season and it's going to start up again in a couple of weeks. But there's almost a sense that nothing really matters now. Because if you've had, it's almost like after a World Cup final and then you go into like some like international friendlies, like it doesn't matter, the big events happen.
Right.
You can't replicate it.
Okay, so back onto Celtic. There's been some talk and rumours about Celtic if Brendan were to move on in the summer, having a director of football type set up. And certainly from my perspective, what you've described, modern football seems to be very much that a manager's at a club. You know, we will have a manager longer than a lot of the clubs that we've talked about as our peers. Managers are there for 2 to 3 years tops.
Yeah.
And so in order to have that planning, that transfer window planning and continuity, you need to have some constant within the club.
Yeah.
And so for me, part of our challenge at the moment is, you know, if Congerton is very much Brendan's guy, well, if Brendan leaves, he leaves. And if Brendan is leaving in the summer, but even if Brendan's not leaving in the summer, whenever Brendan leaves and he leaves, the transfer window or two before he leaves is not a great window for us, because we're asking a guy...
Yeah.
There's no continuity to it. So what are your thoughts on the director of football setup style?
Well, I broadly agree with what you've just said. And also, this summer is going to be especially challenging because it seems as though a lot of key players are going to be leaving.
I think like, got seven players out of contract, like first team, yeah. like part of the, first, the main first team squad, not yeah. the 34 man first team squad, the sort of
yeah,
sort of 15, 17 first team yeah. squad.
And then you look at his centre backs again for those qualifiers. And, well, Benkovic, what, 95% that he wouldn't be playing next season?
Yeah.
Boyata, probably much the same.
Yeah.
So then you're talking about forming a new centre back partnership from yeah. somewhere. Right back, you wouldn't be surprised if we're going to be bringing in a first choice right back over this window or the next window.
Yeah.
Obviously, it seems as though Brown has got an offer from Australia. Mate, I'd hope that he stays, but even if he does stay, it's probably going to be what he's going to be a first teamer for the next year.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then the loan signings, you'd assume they won't be there for next season. So, yeah, there's going to be. It's quite challenging for Celtic.
Uh-huh.
If our director of football does leave, and if there is a change in manager, it is quite a change.
So we should really have the person in charge of the football division out with the first team coaching and playing and selection. He really should be completely separate from the first team manager.
Yeah, and to the point, I would say to the point. I'm not that interested in American sport,
mm-hmm.
but weirdly, I'm quite interested in their kind of director of their teams,
mm-hmm.
And how they kind of, because they have the salary caps and how they kind of deal with
yep.
trading players and kind of, and it seems to me just from kind of like reading articles about it and a couple of books about it, it seems to me that they're quite a bit more advanced than football clubs in a kind of the media scrutiny over that position, firstly. Mm-hmm. But also just, it would be inconceivable that, say, the Chicago Cubs or whoever wouldn't go into a season with the requisite amount of pitchers
mm-hmm.
or people at second base. Like, it would just be farcical. So, like, it seems as though, to me, it seems like director of football should be, obviously have a like good working relationship with the coach,
mm-hmm.
but should be setting out pretty clearly, you know, eye on the budget, eye on what the team's going to be looking like in 18 months' time, look at people's contracts, whether or not to renew, whether to sell at that point, kind of overseeing recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
If maybe he isn't involved kind of in identifying the players, but he should be kind of overseeing that and kind of with an overriding kind of policy of what markets to be looking at.
Yep.
But yeah, that, to me, that seems quite logical. And that it should be a little bit apart. And also, I think, just in like a work environment, that people should be kind of on their toes and be kind of, you know, intellectually challenged by mm-hmm. other people. And that, as well as having a good relationship, you should be able, there should be a little bit of, probably friction is too strong a word, but like, but you can kind of disagree over, say a manager quite reasonably might want a certain player, but it's over the budget, or that you as a director of football don't believe that it's possible for the club to be making anything, any real resale.
Yeah, we sign a player for 12 million and you think top whack we get back for him is 14.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially if you buy it from the market you want to sell them back to.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the clubs have already made their decision on what he's valued at.
Yep.
So I think you can, like, in that kind of football club environment, it's good to have that kind of constant debate and whatever. Not that I've ever worked at a football club, whatever, mm-hmm. but this is just, as an outsider, what I assume would be the ideal.
Okay, so the next thing is, we're going through our transfer window. How do you think the rest of the season's going to pan out? I was having this debate, I was out over Christmas and New Year, and some of the people on our site are nervous about us winning the league. I was quite confident that we'd be 6-9 points clear by the middle of February.
Even now?
Yeah.
This is you talking now? Okay.
This is our turn now, because our first three games after the split are home league games.
Yeah.
And one of them's our game in hand. So I expect us to win all those. So that'll be us 9. Plus the teams behind us are Aberdeen, Kilmarnock and Rangers. And I think in the first four games after the split, I think Rangers play Kilmarnock and Aberdeen play Rangers.
Uh-huh.
So those three teams are playing each other.
Yeah.
Well, we're playing three other teams. I think we play three, then we're away to St Johnstone, and then we play another one at home. So I think we've got four of the next five league games that are at home, and one of them is away to St Johnstone. So we really, really should be looking to get 15 out of 15 points there. And I just don't see, and that would immediately, I don't see any of the three teams behind us getting 12 out of 12.
I would assume that from now to the end of the season, Rangers will get a slightly higher kind of average points than they've been getting up until now.
Why is that?
I think that Davis is quite a decent signing. Cause I don't watch Rangers that often, but when I was back over at Christmas and I watched them at, what is it, Hibs?
Mm-hmm.
I think they played Hibs. And it was much more back and forth than I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I just kind of taken aback, but I thought Rangers would be in control. And, you know, it's maybe a 50-50 game because Hibs are at home or whatever, marginally in favour of Rangers. But it was actually completely back and forth. And I think a player like Davis, he's quite... he's got a nice touch and he chooses kind of like simple passes, and I think he'd be able to bring a bit of like composure and control to Rangers. And I think there'd be a little bit kind of, I wouldn't be surprised if they start to kind of control more of these games against the other SPFL teams. Defoe, I would never want Celtic to be spending that amount of wages on a 36-year-old over, what, 18 months, is it? Or they can cut it after 6.
Yeah, £32,000 a week they're paying him. I don't know where they get the money from.
Yeah. He's very good when he's facing goal and getting shots away around the edge of the box.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe he's slowed up and he can't really... He isn't able to do that anymore in England, but I think in Scotland he'll be able to get shots away at pretty mediocre keepers.
The only thing about that is, though, historically when we've signed strikers who score goals for other teams, when the ball's when the ball's in front of them and they're running onto it, the big problem when they come to Celtic is the ball arrives with a back to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we'll see. I just saw somebody just sent me something that apropos our conversation, because for me, what we talked about earlier about the Celtic and transfer window demonstrates for me that the other problem in Scottish football is some of the teams that you and I have been discussing over the last month or two that make profit out of transfers are on a par size-wise, attendance-wise, revenue-wise with Hibs, Hearts and Aberdeen. And they are making... And we, when the Bosman ruling came along, Scottish football seemed to decide that there was no point in signing people, that what they would do, if they need, they would go out and sign average guys who were in their mid-20s, who had the experience, had played first-team football. They would bring them in on a Bosman. They would then, they bring them in for nothing. They would have a two-year contract, they'd play at the two-year contract, and then they'd leave for nothing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Falkirk, this season, have signed 27 players. 12 have already been released, or their loan has been cut short.
Yeah.
It's the whole of Scottish football. Teams like Aberdeen should be signing people for a million or two and selling people mm-hmm. for 4 or 5 million quid
yeah.
on a
yeah.
regular basis.
Yeah.
None of that is happening.
Their equivalents in Sweden, Denmark, Belgium, Portugal do that.
Yeah.
It was quite funny when I was looking through all of the data, I was going through all of the basically all of the leagues in Central and Western Europe that aren't the big five.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking through all of the kind of the transfer data. That's what struck out when I then looked at Scotland. That I'd seen Sweden, Austria, Switzerland, Portugal, blah, blah, blah. And all of those teams that have stadiums of, what, 12,000, 15,000.
Mm-hmm.
We're all buying and selling continually over the last 10 years. And then you come to Scotland and it was just like minimal fees, like maybe 50,000 or something like that. But the vast majority was free transfers.
Yeah. It's incredible. Anyway, we've depressed people enough on the podcast. So you've not answered my question. Are we going to go on and win the league?
Yeah.
You hesitated.
I did hesitate. Yeah, but like, had we won against Rangers, it would be what, 95%. We'd have been effectively 9 points clear because we'll win at home to St Johnstone, yep. which is the game in hand, and that would have been it done basically.
Yeah.
Now I think my brother was saying that the betting has gone for us to be about 1.45, something like that. Which is probable, but
they're not, like, look, we've spoken about this before. When we had Larson, Sutton and Hartson,
mm-hmm.
and we were at the level of, say, a Liverpool,
yep.
and Rangers had an okay team with, like, Buffalo and whatever, and they were about the standard of Bolton.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you're playing in a league with 10 other teams that are standard of, say, a third tier in England,
yep.
Bolton and Liverpool end up on almost the same points.
Yeah.
So now Rangers are, I think, the second best team in Scotland. And now they've added a pretty decent centre midfielder. And they've added an old striker, whatever. But like, even just with Davis, I think that would improve them. What, we're level on points and we've got a game in hand. So yeah, we should win. We should win the league. But
well, on that cheery note,
sorry. Yeah, I apologise to everyone.
And we say, Mark Cooper, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Bye. Bye.
Bring me sunshine in your smile.
Hope Mark didn't depress you too much with his less than enthusiastic endorsement that Celtic will go on to win the treble, as I fully expect, but you know, each to his own. Anyway, hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sorry they've been so sparse this season. As I keep saying, every single time I've done a podcast this season, there'll be more along shortly. Anyway, enough of me. That was a good 1 hour length or more of podcasting from myself and Mark Cooper. And I know that I've got Lucky Moore, I've got Anthony Murray, I've got Hull Boy, I've got St. Anthony, I've got plenty of other people wanting to be on the podcast again soon, so we'll get them all lined up. I still haven't done the Celtic Underground Top 10 from last season, and I promise we will do that. But anyway, enough of me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Mark Cooper, saying goodnight and God bless. Goodnight.
happiness, so much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love. Bring me sunshine in your smile. Bring me laughter all the while. In this world where we live, there should be more happiness. So much joy you can give to each brand new bright tomorrow. Make me happy through the years. Never bring me any tears. Let your arms be as warm as the sun from up above. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love, sweet love. Bring me fun, bring me sunshine, bring me love.